podcast from the Royal Air Force Museum. For further information, please go to www.rafmuseum.org/podcasts. On the 18th of February 1944, the Royal Air Force launched one of its most daring wartime raids. In broad daylight, Mosquito aircraft of 140 Wing executed a low-level bombing attack on the formidable prison of Amiens in the heart of occupied France. To attempt such a raid is remarkable enough. That they were successful is testament to the courage and skill of those involved. This podcast tells the exceptional story of Operation Jericho, the Amiens raid.
Mosquitoes of 140 Wing are to attack the prison at Amiens in an attempt to assist 120 prisoners to escape. These prisoners are French patriots condemned to death for assisting the Allies.
The winter of 1943-44 was a particularly harsh one for the resistance groups operating in northern France. With D-Day rapidly approaching, it was vital that the secret armies were fully prepared for invasion. Yet all over the region, SOE circuits collapsed under the weight of multiple betrayals. Arms caches were uncovered, and a large number of resistance workers, including many key players, now languished within the colossal walls of Amiens prison. Many found themselves facing execution as the Germans implemented a harsh crackdown. A number of desperate rescue attempts were made, such as the ill-fated run on the prison at San Quentin, during which 12 men died and nobody escaped. As the Germans redoubled their vigilance at all prisons, it was clear that a similar ground attack on Amiens would be impossible. Help was needed, and the resistance turned to Dominique Ponchardier, head of the Amiens underground district, who had contacts in the British intelligence service. Initially, no formal request for help was made, and Ponchardier simply sent detailed plans of the prison through to London, outlining everything from the layout of prison to the timings of meals. The intelligence received the plans without question, unaware of their intended purpose. Then in February 1944, a message arrived asking the RAF to assist with the escape of prisoners from Amiens, and the intelligence found that they just so happened to have all the details necessary to plan the raid. When Ponchardier's request reached London, the intelligence immediately recognised the morale-boosting effects of such a raid. Many an RAF pilot owed his life to the work of the resistance, and here was a chance to return the favour. The operation, if viable, would fall to the Mosquito bombers of 2 Group Bomber Command, so with haste that their commander, Air Vice Marshal Basil Embry, was summoned. In his opinion, the raid would be possible, but the risks were high. A prison is not a military target, and it would be difficult to carry out the attack without loss of life. Embry stressed that meticulous planning would be required, with every possible element scrutinised in minute detail, starting with the prison itself. Amiens prison was a large grey building, cruciform in shape and surrounded by a massive wall, 20 feet high, 3 feet wide, and topped liberally with broken glass. It was heavily guarded by specially selected German troops who were accommodated inside the prison itself. Any attack would have to consist of 2 separate strikes, one to breach the outer wall and another to break open the internal doors without harming the occupants. It would mean low-level bombing runs, pinpoint accuracy, and an immediate steep climb to avoid crashing into the main building. Timing between aircraft would be critical if aircrew casualties were to be avoided. One of the most vital elements was the amount of explosive force needed to breach the thick walls and force the locks on the prison cells. Too little would fail the attack, but too much would cause excessive casualties. To add to the pressure, an execution date for 120 of the prisoners had been set for the 19th of February.
All aircraft are to attack at low level. 6 Mosquitoes are to break the outer wall in at least 2 places. A further 6 are to bomb the main prison buildings.
Despite the difficulties, the plan gradually formed and preparations for the operation began. It was decided to breach the outer wall in 2 places to give the best possible chance of escape. If one route became blocked by debris or guards, then there would be another way out. They also needed to eliminate as many guards as possible at the beginning of the raid, which meant destroying areas where the guards were quartered. It had been noted that at 12 noon the prisoners would be assembled for lunch, but more importantly, so would the guards. Therefore, the time selected for the attack was 12 noon precisely, on any day between the 10th and 19th of February. With the plans approved, crew selection could begin. It had already been agreed that pilots from Embry's 140 Wing would carry out the attack in their sleek new de Havilland Mosquito Mark 6s. They had quickly proved their worth in successful attacks against V1 launch sites, flying 139 sorties in the first half of February alone. 18 aircraft were chosen from 487 Squadron Royal New Zealand Air Force, 464 Squadron Royal Australian Air Force and 21 Squadron RAF. Hawker Typhoons from 198 Squadron would provide fighter support, and a Mosquito from the Operational Film Production Unit would capture the raid on film for propaganda purposes. Basil Embry elected to lead the raid himself. An exceptionally courageous pilot, he had been four times awarded the Distinguished Service Order for bravery in action and liked to lead by example. However, his seniors had other ideas and forbade him from leading the raid on the grounds that if captured he would be dealt with harshly due to his high position within the Air Force. This was a major blow for Embry and left him in a difficult position. He needed to appoint a new leader for the operation and time was fast running out. Embry had chosen as his deputy one Group Captain Percy Charles Pickard. An experienced bomber pilot, Pickard had made a name for himself as the reluctant star of the Bomber Command propaganda film Target for Tonight. In addition to his many successful high-level bombing raids, he had also been in command of 161 Special Duty Squadron, flying Lysanders into occupied Europe. However, Embry felt that Pickard lacked the necessary experience to lead Operation Jericho. After all, he had only been on five or six low-level sorties and none so risky as this. But Embry knew that to pass Pickard over for another would cause deep hurt, so despite his misgivings, selected Pickard to lead the operation. With the final piece of the plan in place, the success of Operation Jericho now hinged on the inclement British weather. The winter of 1943-44 had been a snowy one, and the blizzard sweeping across RAF Hunsdon had become a familiar sight. The crews had been called to many an early briefing, only to find all sorties called off due to bad weather. The 17th of February was no different, but unfortunately this was the provisional date set for the Amiens raid. As Embry and Pickard surveyed the howling snowstorm, Operation Jericho looked in doubt. A 24-hour postponement was called in the vain hope of an improvement in weather. However, February the 18th dawned misty and snowy, and meteorological reports were not encouraging. As ground mist swept across the bleak airfield, Embry observed grimly that it was now or never, regardless of the conditions. Tomorrow would be too late for the prisoners of Amiens. The crews were called to early briefing, and as they filed into the unusually heavily guarded room, there was an air of speculation about the nature of their mission. The details of the operation had been made known only to a select few, but now the highly secret nature of the raid was impressed upon the gathered crews. With formalities out of the way, a perfect scale model of the prison was revealed and the briefing commenced. As Pickard spoke, an air of determination filled the room. Despite the great risks involved, everybody wanted to take part in this raid, aimed to save lives, not destroy them. In one simple sentence, Pickard cemented their decision, saying,
"They have told us they would rather be blown up by British bombs than shot by the Nazis."
As the last details of the briefing were given, the men crowded round to look at the model and memorise the detail. Pickard's last words to the assembled crews would turn out to be tragically prophetic.
"Well, boys, this is a death or glory show."
With the briefing over, the crews moved out to dispersal, where their aircraft were being fuelled and bombed up by frozen ground crews. Amidst a swirling snowstorm, the Mosquitoes left Hunsdon, climbing rapidly into heavy cloud. In the blinding conditions, four Mosquitoes became detached from the rest of the wing, and with reluctance were forced to turn for home. The remaining 14 aircraft headed for their rendezvous with the Typhoons over Littlehampton. It was soon apparent that the weather had caused havoc here too, as the escort of 12 had been reduced to 8. Nevertheless, the remaining 22 aircraft made for the Channel, leaving behind the treacherous weather for the sunny but snow-covered plains of Picardy. As they neared Amiens, it was easy to pick out the long, straight Albert Road that marked out the run into the prison. At this point, the Mosquito of Flight Lieutenant Titch Hannafin was forced to turn back with engine trouble, leaving a final attack force of 13 aircraft. Below them, the French underground workers waited with bated breath, just as they had done every day since the 12th of February. As noon approached, it looked as though they would be disappointed once more, but at 1 minute past 12, specks began to appear on the horizon. Just 3 minutes behind schedule, Operation Jericho was about to commence.
Leading three aircraft to attack Eastern Wall using Main Road as lead-in. Second section of three aircraft to watch leading three aircraft and then attack Northern Wall on a north-south run, immediately following the explosion.
At Treetop Height, Wing Commander Ian Smith of 487 Squadron swept along the Albert Road, with Pilot Officer Sparks and Flight Sergeant Jennings close behind. They placed their 11-second delay bombs by the western wall and swiftly began the steep climb over the main prison building. After waiting for the detonation, Pilot Officer Fowler and Pilot Officer Darrell flew in for their attack. Aware of people near the northern wall, they dropped their bomb short but managed to blow two holes through it. With the walls breached, it was time to attack the buildings.
Leading three aircraft to attack southeastern end of main building and second section to attack the northwestern end.
Wing Commander Bob Iredale led the 464 Squadron assault on the prison building, landing his bomb squarely on the guards' dining hall. The final two aircraft dropped theirs on the main building to blow the doors. Inside the prison was chaos. The eerie silence that had followed the explosions was soon replaced with shouting and crying as those inside took stock of the situation. Although most of the bombs had been successful, a number of wide novas had caused considerable internal damage. Walls and floors had collapsed, and a number of prisoners had either been killed or were badly injured or trapped. As the prisoners slowly regained their wits, a scramble for the exits began. Most made their way to the breached walls, but several men stayed behind to tend to the fallen and trapped. Among these were Dr. Manns and Captain Tempest. Of all the stories to emerge from the rubble of Amiens, theirs is perhaps the most poignant. Disregarding their own chance for freedom, Captain Tempest and others dug frantically through the debris to reach those trapped, while Dr. Manns tended to the wounds of the injured. They saved many lives that day, but for their efforts, Manns spent the rest of the war in a labour camp, and Tempers and his friends died before a firing squad.
Daddy from Dipeg. Red, red, red.
Unaware of the drama unfolding below, Group Captain Picard circled the prison to check the damage. He observed that both walls had been breached and quickly gave the order to 21 Squadron, who had been held in reserve, to return to Hunsdon without attacking. By this time, enemy fighters had been scrambled hastily from the airfield at nearby Gleazy and were making trouble for the escorting Typhoons. Before long, the Focke Wulf 190s claimed their first victim, Squadron Leader Ian McRitchie of 464 Squadron. The shell, which had instantly killed his navigator, Flight Lieutenant Sammy Sampson, temporarily blinded McRitchie and rendered his right arm useless. Miraculously, he managed to make an emergency landing not far from Albert and was taken prisoner of war. It is not certain exactly what happened next, but it seems that McRitchie's crash caught the attention of Group Captain Picard. Whatever the reason, Picard broke off from the returning force and was seen to fly low over the spot where McRitchie was downed. French eyewitness reports claim Picard's aircraft, F for Freddy, was hit by flak. Within seconds, two Focke Wulf 190s were upon him, and a burst of gunfire shot away the tail section. F for Freddy flicked over onto its back and ploughed straight into the ground. A group of French villagers rushed to the burning aircraft, but Picard and Broadley were already dead, apparently killed by the impact of the crash. The villagers quickly burned any official papers and hid the camera and film from the aircraft in a nearby rabbit burrow. Bodies were taken to the mayor's house and buried the following day at Saint-Pierre Cemetery, where they remain to this day. The wings and medal ribbons from Picard's uniform were sent to his wife Dorothy, along with a touching letter of gratitude for the sacrifice made. One Typhoon had already been lost in the dogfight over Gleazy, and another was forced to ditch in the channel by a harsh blizzard. A third, crippled by battle damage, had to make a forced landing in Sussex. The Mosquito Force fared little better. Flight Lieutenant Hannafin, who had earlier been forced to turn back with engine trouble, was hit by flak. A jagged piece of shrapnel had sliced into his neck, and the wound was bleeding profusely. Despite losing all feeling in his right side, Hannafin, with the help of his navigator, made an incredible emergency landing in Sussex. Pilot Officer Sparks was to be the final casualty before the raid was over. His flak-damaged aircraft was written off during an emergency landing, but the crew escaped with minor injuries. The object of Operation Jericho had been achieved, but the cost had been heavy. 102 inmates had been killed, although many of these had fallen victim to machine gun fire from the German guards. In addition, the RAF had lost one of its most brilliant bomber pilots, something which the Hunsdon crews struggled to come to terms with. The feeling in the mess was summed up by Squadron Leader Dick Sugden.
We waited until late at night, but there was no news. It was unbelievable, but there it was.
The deaths of Picard and Broadley had not been in vain, however. A total of 258 prisoners escaped from Amiens that day, including 29 political prisoners and 50 resistance workers. Among these were 12 men who would have been executed the next day. Initial reaction to the raid was subdued as the French struggled to understand the motives of the RAF. Official details of Operation Jericho were withheld whilst the liberation of France took place. By this time, the feelings of the people of Amiens had turned to gratitude as news of the return of their vital resistance workers was leaked. a message of thanks was quickly sent to London. It was not until the 28th of October 1944 that the British public finally heard about the raid in one of the Gen newswheels.
In Amiens jail, over 100 French patriots awaited execution. The RAF came to their rescue. Group Captain Picard led the attack. One of the most exacting attacks of the war had succeeded. The walls had been breached, many Germans had been killed, over 100 French patriots had joined their friends outside.
Over time, the ethics of Operation Jericho have been questioned, as often happens in the aftermath of war. However, this cannot detract from the skill and courage of all involved. Jericho remains one of the most meticulously planned and brilliantly executed raids of the Second World War, and one cannot ignore the enormous risk taken by all involved. At least 12 men owe their lives to the bravery of the Hunsdon crews. In the words of one of the navigators involved,
"This was the sort of operation that gave you the feeling that if you did nothing else in the war, you had done something."
Thanks for listening to this podcast from the Royal Air Force Museum.